Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
I'm privileged today to really have an outstanding guest, someone I would love to talk to or just have coffee with, because he has such a broad range of knowledge and insight. This is You, the Owner's Manual podcast, number 904B, and our guest is Gregory Petsko, who's the Arthur J. Mahan Professor of Neurology and Neuroscience and Director of the Helen and Robert Apple Alzheimer's Disease Research Institute at Weill Cornell Medical College, where his wife was dean. She's now moved to Boston. He will be doing that. She's going to be the CEO and president, or maybe already is, of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. So obviously we could talk about Alzheimer's disease. We could talk about chemistry. We could talk about his loves. But what I really am going to start to talk about is the process of science. He has a distinguished career in science and how he got involved in understanding the, if you will, decoding medical studies for the common man is something we ought to ask him. So let me start that way. Dr. Petsko, how did you get involved in this subject?
Well, I did. By the way, thanks for having me on. I much appreciate it. I got involved in it the way I seem to get involved in most things, sort of inadvertently. About 15 years ago, I started working on neurodegenerative diseases. And in order to do that, I had to understand what was known about neurodegenerative diseases and what was being published both in the scientific press and in the lay press about the diseases and about attempts to cure them. So there was a process of self-education and reflection. And then around about the same time, I started giving public lectures about the aging of the population and the implications of that for public health and so forth. And in order to do a good job on that, I had to become familiar with the topic you've just been talking about. So I didn't set out to do it, but like the fellow who jumped into a cactus patch, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, let's go in. Your history is that of a what you would call a structural biochemist. Is that a correct phrase?
It'll do as well as any other.
And which obviously is to understand the protein's three and even four-dimensional structure and design or understand chemical reactions in the biochemistry, and I assume of the human body now that you're going into, that specifies with it. And I noticed one thing in the information I was sent is you probably would say that any mouse study or we often hear this drug cures cancer in mice. And I say, you know, orange juice would cure cancer in mice, or too much orange juice causes cancer in mice, so you can't depend much on those studies.
I'm not a big fan of mouse studies for many human diseases. Like everything else, it's not black and white, although some mice are. It's the sort of thing that you have to ask yourself, what's the disease? What's the nature of the study? What's it intended to do? And how is it interpreted? But as a general rule, for the most complicated human diseases, which would include things like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and other diseases of the brain, it's tough to get good mouse models. Mice don't get these diseases spontaneously. You have to grossly manipulate the genome or the biochemistry of the animal in order to get any kind of response. The response usually doesn't mimic very well what happens in the degenerating human brain. And if we could do without those models, it would be great. Unfortunately, they seem to be necessary to get treatments approved for testing in people. But the success rate is so poor in transitioning from mice to humans in that regard that I really think we would be better off thinking about better models.
Well, it's interesting. I was around in the era when these, quote, genetic models, so there's a genetic maybe in fact several genetic models of Alzheimer's disease in mice, where they develop neurodegeneration that looks like human Alzheimer's plaques, et cetera. But before that, we used, if you will, crazy methods to develop the diseases in animals. So when I was at NIH in the late 60s, early 70s, in fact, the group in the next lab was causing dementia by giving an infection in the paw and then adding coconut oil to the animal to apparently decrease blood-brain barrier. And that's how they caused it. So the models now are genetic, though. That is, we modify the genes of the animals or select the animals for certain diseases and breed them. Do you think the change in models has caused this, meaning the genetics aren't the same in mice and humans?
No, not so much that. But remember, first of all, only about 5% of Alzheimer's cases are truly genetic to begin with. And another problem is if you do manipulate the mouse genes or introduce human genes into the mice in order to try to get a phenotype that resembles the human disease, in practice it never really does very well. So, for example, Alzheimer's disease is characterized by both plaques and tangles. They're particular types of misfolded proteins. And most of the mouse models have one but not the other, whereas the human disease always has both. And the neurons that degenerate in these mouse models are usually not the same as the neurons that typically degenerate, especially early in the case of human Alzheimer's disease and so forth. So the models, if the models were imperfect, that would be one thing, because we could live with the imperfections as long as we understood what they were. But there's a worry on the part of many of us in the field that these models may actually be irrelevant or misleading, and that would be much worse.
And the problem with interpreting the data on this is that we're, and let me not put words in your mouth, but to complete the sentence is that we're then interpreting the effect of drugs or treatments or processes on diseases in mice that don't exist or that aren't similar to humans. Would that be correct?
That's exactly right. I mean, hundreds of clinical trials in people have been started based on positive results in these imperfect mouse models, and none of them have succeeded. Now, there are a number of reasons or possible reasons why they haven't succeeded, but one of the reasons is that the animal models aren't really teaching us what we need to know.
And now, this is true of Alzheimer's disease. So one of the frustrations that obviously most people, as they get older or as they're contemplating their aging, must feel, since the majority dread memory loss and the Alzheimer's in specific, is that progress has been so slow. It's obviously drug companies have spent a ton of money on this. So the point of this is, what do you think the answer is? You're in the field. How do we go about doing this better?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question. I'll give you my perspective on it. There will be other perspectives you could get. My perspective is that we need to have a larger number of trials exploring a larger number of options. The particular type of clinical trials that have gone on in Alzheimer's disease have tended to focus on one biochemical pathway as being the most likely to produce some kind of cure or modification of the disease. And that hasn't panned out very well. I think we have to cast our net much wider. We have to be more creative and imaginative in the ways we attempt to attack the disease.
And tell me a little more about what you mean by that, more creative in the ways we attack the disease. So what we know, and maybe you can tell us better than I can, but what we know in Alzheimer's or in memory dysfunction is it's usually a group or concatenation of things. But the people have gone after the beta amyloid protein and the tangles, which are called tau, as two of the most, I guess, anatomically relevant things.
Yep, that's correct. So you remember the old joke about the drunk looking for his keys under a streetlight, and the policeman comes up to him and says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm looking for my keys." Policeman says, "I can help you. Where did you drop them?" And the drunk says, "Over there in that dark corner." And the policeman says, "Well, why are you looking for them here?" And the drunk says, "The light's better here." Well, the point is, we can see the plaques and the tangles. They're the big, as you say, anatomical signals of the disease. So everybody figured if you intervene with those, you would be affecting the disease. Interestingly enough, in 1911, in the second paper he ever wrote on the disease, Alois Alzheimer himself said he thought the plaques were likely to be caused by the disease, not causing the disease.
And that obviously would lead to different therapies than have been tried. In other words, there are a lot of and I would love to get into the immunotherapy for cancer since you're going to Dana-Farber in the near future, but I think that's a reasonable model of the failure initially of the immunotherapy trials in humans, and then the ultimate success almost caused by the persistence of a few people. But the point is that they were looking at it in the wrong way or with the wrong endpoints even initially.
Yeah, I think one could be probably a little kinder to them than that. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time. It was a logical thing to try. But it may be that we've beaten that particular dead horse long enough. I think it would be good to explore what's actually going on inside the dying neuron, the pathways that are affected. I think it'd be better to look at some of the early events that are taking place of the disease. We know that protein trafficking inside the cell is disrupted very early. We also know there appear to be early changes involving cells of the immune system. There's a bunch of things like that that would be, I think, interesting and maybe very exciting to look at from a therapeutic perspective. And it's not true that they're being ignored. There are a number of groups now that are beginning to look at those, but we probably should have done so earlier than this.
Now, let's get into a little bit about decoding science in general. So we often see headlines, and some of them are, for example, and I'll just give you some that, if you will, I saw today. Cauliflower, kale, and carrots may lower breast cancer risk, and that if you have under 5 pregnancies and are a woman, you decrease your risk of Alzheimer's disease, but over 5, you increase it. And if you will, probably the one I love the best because it was an intervention study, and we should get into the difference of intervention studies. But it was done in Philadelphia where they randomly allocated vacant lots into cleaning them up and planting gardens or leaving them alone, and looked at the mental function of people who were visiting those various lots. So tell me, if you see a story like that is cauliflower, kale, and carrots lower breast cancer risk, what do you think of?
Well, I think of salad, but probably I shouldn't. First of all, you always have to ask yourself, what's the magnitude of the effect? So in that particular case, I don't know what the lowering of the risk is.
Okay, so I do. So let me tell you, it was a minor lowering, 11%.
Yeah. See, I don't get excited about anything unless it's 30, 40% or more, because these small percentage changes in risks, first of all, they're often dangerously close to the noise level of the study. Second, it's amazing how often other studies come along that show a similar magnitude in exactly the opposite direction. And third, you know, a 10% change in risk isn't much of a change. as far as modifying one's lifestyle is concerned. So I think one of the first things that the average person should do is take a good look at how big the change in risk or whatever is. And if it's not a really dramatic number, I wouldn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. So that's the first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say, and you don't have to be technically adept to do this, for anything, even when you don't know much about the topic, always consult your old friend Cui, as in cui bono, which is Latin for who profits, who is safe or satisfied or sound or solvent if I believe this. I think if you ask yourself that question, you have a much better chance of detecting bias in a study, of guessing whether or not there are hidden motives or objectives behind it, of understanding whether people have a conflict of interest or the possibility that they themselves will directly benefit from your believing what they say. Always ask yourself, who profits from this? If you can figure that out, and usually you can, you don't necessarily have to know the science to know whether you can trust what's being said.
And so one of the things, if you look at, this was actually, that was study was a large analysis of the Nihanes of 185,000 people, but showed a very, if you will, small effect. And you'd say, well, maybe there's a logic behind fruits and vegetables affecting this, but it's a pretty small effect. So one is, look behind who benefits. Is this study done by the milk board, for example, or the pork board, or someone else that has
a kale consortium
that has a chance of financially benefiting? The second thing is, you pointed out, was that study that I, there are two studies, one of which, or actually it's one study that shows that if you have five pregnancies or less, you decrease your risk of Alzheimer's disease, epidemiologically determined by 50% or 45%. But the converse is if you increase your number of children to six or more, it increased your risk of Alzheimer's disease twofold. So the contrast doesn't make much sense.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, these are often cases where there are confounding variables, things that link the reported connections together in a way that's completely different. So, for example, maybe people who have fewer children tend to have a certain type of lifestyle that's healthier or that leads to, in a very different way, reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease. Maybe their social or economic status is completely different. People with larger families, I don't know, if you had more than five children, it would seem to me you'd be driven crazy.
That was my comment exactly, but the if you will, the so part of it is knowing the magnitude of effect. Second is knowing in what species it's done. Is it in humans or not? Is it an intervention trial? This was epidemiologic, which means we get it from actually just seeing what behaviors rather than interventions that randomly allocate people to one behavior or another. And so magnitude, species, and the design of the study. How do people...
Yeah, in this case, of course, it's not designed at all. As you say, it's just epidemiology, which is a great science, but always is potentially at risk for linking things together that are actually connected through some completely other effect.
Now, what else should someone know? How did they find this out? When you read the articles, for example, when you just read what the science writer of the New York Times wrote on one of these pieces, there's no magnitude of effect given. What do you do then? Do you say the layperson should go back to the science or just forget about it?
Well, I think you have a couple of options. One is you can check other coverage of the same story and see if they're more comprehensive. A science writer who doesn't report the magnitude of the effect has failed their duty, so other people might do a better job of it. you could email or make another attempt to get in touch with the writer of the study, of the article about the study, to see if they can give you that information. You could also try to dig out the original literature paper, and even though you wouldn't understand the scientific jargon, probably in the abstract of that article, you'll find a statement of the magnitude of the effect, so you could at least look at that. And that same article, if you could find it, usually you could find these things online, though not always, should tell you who paid for the study, and that's very important.
We've only got a couple minutes left. Do you have any other comments you want to make? I feel like I want to talk to you forever, Dr. Petsko. But in any case, any other comments? If you were betting, where would you think that the science of treating Alzheimer's disease would be in 5 years?
If you'd asked me this 10 years ago, I'd have been pessimistic. I'm now cautiously optimistic. I think within the next 5, 6, 7 years, we're going to have at least one, maybe more than one, treatment that modifies the disease progression in a significant way. Where that's going to come from, I don't know. We have a treatment of our own that'll be in clinical trials in about a year and a half. Maybe it'll come from there. Maybe it'll come from somebody else's work. But I think there's reason to be optimistic, cautiously. I think the field is making progress. I think we're getting away from some of the unproductive lines of inquiry, and I have hope that we'll have something pretty soon. We're going to need to, because by the middle of this century, there will be more people with Alzheimer's disease than the population of the state of Illinois in the United States.
Yes, we will. Since my field is aging, obviously, since I am aging, but the research area I work on is related to aging and what we can do about it, I actually have gotten much more hope as well. So as I guess someone says, from your lips to God's ears, we have a number of therapies that work as many of the dementias as is possible. So I'm glad you're optimistic on that.
Amen to that.
I want to thank you very much. We've been talking to Gregory Petsko, who has no website for you to turn to if you will. He's just here to educate us and to help us learn. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time. And this is one gentleman whose time is really precious, not just for us, but for all mankind. So thank you very much, Dr. Petsko, and Godspeed on working on a solution.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week with another interesting guest. No one can be, I don't think, as good as Dr. Petsko. How to Decode Medical Studies was the topic, but we talked about a lot more. Next week, Jonathan Deutsch will be with us. He's going to talk about the new and emerging food trends and why I'm being served cauliflower steak and whether that's good for us. We'll turn in next week. And always on Tuesdays, the news of the week and what it means for you on You, the Owner's Manual podcast. Thanks again for listening. And Darian, thanks for great engineering. We'll be back next week.